Earlier this week, Governor Tony Evers released a set of proposals to change Wisconsin's election laws and practices, coinciding with his 2023 budget address. Among them, automatic voter registration and changes to voter ID processes. He also called for a new Office of Election Transparency and Compliance. In a statement, Evers said, quote, "Even as some politicians continue their efforts to undermine our safe, secure elections, restrict access to the ballot box, and control the outcomes of our elections, I have and will continue to defend and support the right to vote, our clerks, poll workers, and election administrators, and the opportunity to participate in our democracy." We're going to talk about the effects some of those changes could have on the way elections function in Wisconsin if they make it through a Republican-controlled legislature. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a change you'd like to see in the way elections are run in Wisconsin? What do you think of that idea, automatic voter registration, when you register for a driver's license and confirm that you are a voting citizen? Should you automatically get registered to vote? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Christina LaPlante is an assistant professor of political science and public administration at UW-La Crosse, where her specialties include political behavior, campaign advertising, and public opinion. Christina, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be back.
Let's dive right into some of these proposed changes. First of all, this idea of automatic voter registration. I understand something like 20-ish other states have something like this. We don't in Wisconsin currently. What is that system? How does it work?
So I think, like you could had mentioned earlier, right, like the motor voter laws, right, we go to the DMV, we're getting our driver's license, and then automatically you are registered to vote. I think that there's this tendency to think that when we expand access to the ballot box, that this kind of inherently advantages Democrats, and it's part of this leftist agenda, which is often, unfortunately, kind of how we hear these things discussed in contemporary politics, that, you know, this key element, this key tenet of democracy, access to the ballot box, has surprisingly been politicized in our hyper political landscape. But I think people can breathe maybe a breath of fresh air knowing that, you know, places like Georgia, who are constantly under fire for restrictive voting measures, even places like Georgia have automatic voter registration in place.
And then Governor Evers talked about election transparency. So a lot of talk about how elections work over the last couple of years, some attacks on the way things work. The governor's saying he wants an office focused on ways of it would be called Office of Election Transparency and Compliance. What do you think of that idea? And maybe, I think, hoping to allay concerns or fears about the way elections work.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the primary reason that we're seeing these type of proposals introduced across state legislatures really has to do with the backlash of, you know, the 2020 election and combating all of these ideas that, you know, there's something wrong or suspicious about American elections, that when you go and vote on election day, you need to be vigilant, right? You need to, make sure that everything's going off the way that it should be. And again, I think it's all kind of really reactionary to this messaging and this narrative that, you know, fraud is rampant in American elections. And it's, you know, honestly quite sad. We look at, studies and empirical assessments of voter fraud in the United States. Of course, it happens. But, you know, there's absolutely no empirical evidence that would suggest that fraud is so pervasive that it has had the power to change the outcome of an election, right? We have zero empirical evidence that would suggest that that's the case. But nonetheless, we've seen, you know, members of the United States Congress weaponize this type of rhetoric. And, you know, people buy into these messages. We look to our representatives and our senators, right, to give us cues about policy issues. And what I guess to make a long story short, I think what you really see is, you know, people genuinely afraid about the integrity of American elections, and Evers trying to get ahead of this and, propose things that will make elections a little bit more transparent.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm against the motor voter registration. I'll tell you why. I lived in Illinois for a time, and I went to renew my driver's license. My birthday was in November, and I was registered twice because I went there early before my birthday to renew my driver's license. So I was on the voter rolls twice. When I went to vote that day, I was challenged, and it introduced a whole process that had to me, I had to prove my identity, go home and get my passport, prove my residency and stuff. I think it creates more problems than it solves, because you could register with your first name and your last name, or you could register with your first name and middle initial, and you could be registered twice and technically get away with voting twice. I don't like the idea of it, and I'm against it.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. I think there have been efforts, Christina, to make sure that people don't show up on the voter rolls twice, but not impossible, Jeff says.
Yeah, well, first of all, I have to just really sympathize with Jeff on that issue. You know, it's really difficult to trust the bureaucracy to do things right in this country. My last name is LaPlante, right? And on half of my government records, there's a space between the A and the P, and there's not a space between the A and the P. And I can absolutely sympathize with that story there, because that has presented problems for me as well. You know, going to voting or, you know, trying to get a passport. So I absolutely agree, right? It's important to hear from voters their experiences with these type of things. And if we are going to adopt a system that gives the government more exercise over these things, that we need to do our best to be in front of any potential issues that could cause, obstacles like Jeff just mentioned.
We're talking to Christina LaPlante, Assistant Professor of Political Science and Public Administration at UW La Crosse, taking a look at some of the voting changes Governor Evers is calling for that he says will make it easier for Wisconsinites to cast ballots. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Motor voter, automatic registration for voters, for or against it. One thing we'll talk about, the idea of allowing polling places to start counting absentee ballots before the polls open on election day. Some states do it. We don't. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you manage a local election system, if you've been a poll worker, what are you hearing from the governor's plans? We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Christina LaPlante is with us, Assistant Professor of Political Science and Public Administration at UW La Crosse, looking at some voting policy changes proposed this week by Governor Evers as part of his two-year budget proposal. Christina, another idea here is to say, okay, absentee ballots come in before Election Day. The governor wants polling stations to be able to count those maybe before Election Day, which they can't now. It ends up creating some of these late night situations in places that process all their ballots in one place, like Milwaukee. What are you looking at with that idea?
I think that that's an excellent idea. I've seen very little arguments as to why we shouldn't allow our polling precincts to count these early. And when we look back at 2020, right, when states had massively expanded access to the ballot box and had adopted all of these new rules, and like, what were people most concerned about? The suspicious nature of expanding access, and isn't that going to make fraud more likely? And if you look at the kind of conspiracy theories that were circling social networks or social media networks, a big concern was the suspicion about, why is it taking so long to count these ballots? Even former President Donald Trump used that as kind of a justification for, there must be something suspicious going on here. So I actually think that this is a move in the right direction, that if we can count the ballots a little bit more quickly and kind of cut out this anxiety of the mixture, I think that that's going to help Americans feel a little bit more confident in our elections.
Now, you are on a college campus. One change the governor wants to see is to make sure that UW system and Wisconsin Technical College system ID cards comply with voter identification requirements, so that if you have one of these campus IDs, it counts as the voter ID required to vote. Is that something you see students on your campus have a concern about?
Oh, personally, I haven't heard anything from my students here on the campus about that. But I mean, certainly, I think that, again, kind of like we talked about at the very beginning of the call, there's this kind of appetite currently in American politics, that this idea of expanding access to the ballot box is just kind of rife with the potential for fraud, and people feel they have a lot of mixed feelings about that, right? And I think that what is just really important to recognize is looking at states that make it easier to vote have higher turnout. I mean, it's unheard of, right? Minnesota having that 80% of eligible voters turning out in 2020. We need to kind of not be so moved by the narratives we hear about, you know, all of the potential for negative consequences of expanding access at the ballot box, and really bring it back to the central tenets of democracy, that expanding access to the ballot is a good thing, that in theory, right, ought everyone be able to vote in a representative democracy, and really embracing those values as a as an American.
Time for one more caller. Miko is with us in Wausau. Miko, hi.
Yeah, hi. My name is Miko. I'm a German citizen. I'm a permanent resident here in Wausau, Wisconsin. I just want to point out that there is just such an easy way to solve all this for the entire country, which is a thing called Einwohnermeldepflicht, which is a big word for the you must register with the municipality you live in. Within 1 month of moving there, then, or living there, you get a letter in the mail for each vote that happens, whether it's on a local or national level. You go with that form that you get, or that postcard, you go to the voting booth and take it there with a valid ID, and then you can vote. So all these different methods of registering for voting, depending on which state or municipality you live in, all that goes away because you get this thing in the mail, and it's an official piece of mail, and everyone recognizes it.
Miko, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Miko hits a key point, Christina. I think a lot of countries, Germany and many others, elections are managed at the national level. And in the United States, they are not. They, like, the states very jealously guard their ability to control the elections. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I love that comment, and I wanted to even take it a step further.
Sure.
Like you mentioned, some other European countries that just the concept of voter registration just doesn't exist, right? And, you know, how do people feel about that? Let's just outright get rid of voter registration in the United States. And, you know, how does that make us feel? But no, again, federalism is a very key tenet in our government and in our democracy, that, listen, the federal government does its thing, the states do its thing. And one of the things that the states does is manage elections. So I really don't see that going anywhere anytime soon.
Miko, thanks for the call. And Christina, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Christina LaPlante is an assistant professor of political science and public administration at UW La Crosse. We talked to her today about some of the proposals from Governor Tony Evers on changing voting laws in Wisconsin. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You may have seen headlines about chatbots and neural networks, things like ChatGPT. Now they're getting closer to being parts of our everyday lives. Just last week, both Microsoft and Google announced plans to incorporate these kind of chatbots into their search engines so that you can have at least what looks like a conversation with a so-called artificial intelligence chatbot instead of just that list of results you usually get. But these machine-generated conversations are developing a bit of a reputation for producing inaccurate results and some seemingly bizarre behavior. Part of the story is the way language itself works. Gary Lupien is a cognitive scientist and professor of psychology at UW-Madison. Gary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
These chatbot programs, can you talk a little bit about the way they work, the large language models that they're trained in?
Sure, yeah. I think we're in for quite a ride in this next few years, and it's been fascinating to watch. I studied neural networks in the early 2000s when I was in grad school, and you know, they were scientifically very interesting, but really worked on just toy models, toy data sets. And now with much more powerful computers and the ability to train them on much, much more data, they're all grown up. And so essentially they are trained by feeding them, these language models are trained by feeding them large amounts of language scraped from the internet, from different sources. And they try to predict words given other words. And so it's a very, very simple procedure. But what's incredible is that this simple task that they are being asked to do produces all kinds of unexpected outcomes. So in just trying to predict the surrounding words, they end up learning all kinds of things, not just single facts, but concepts and how to combine them in novel ways. So that's when people say, oh, they're just predicting words, strictly speaking, that's true. But in the course of doing that, they end up learning a whole lot more.
Let's talk about learning, what we mean by that phrase. My feeling is that if I went and looked at a bunch of data and tried to talk about it, I don't know, something different is going on in my brain versus this neural network and it predicting and combining these ideas.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't feel like we're doing anything of the sort. It doesn't feel like we're predicting in this way. But actually, there's lots of evidence that we are. So if you are listening to a musical melody and a note is off, you realize that something is wrong because you were predicting one thing and you got something else. And the same thing happens in language. If someone uses the wrong word, you notice because you were, in fact, making a prediction. And so we're running these kinds of, as people, we're doing a lot of the same kind of thing, even though it's not our goal to predict. We're not actively trying to predict what someone is about to say. In the background, that's kind of what we're doing. And so we also learn in other ways, but that way of predictive learning is an important component of human learning as well.
Now, you've, I understand, engaged some with ChatGPT. What kind of things have you tried? What have your experiences been like?
What kinds of things? Well, one thing I've tried is giving it questions for my exams. And I was kind of blown away because the more the question tapped into kind of critical thinking and synthesis, the better it seemed to do. And the questions that it was getting wrong were probably ones that were not as good. They were asking about more isolated facts, about more kind of specific details. So that was one surprise. The other one was just having it write outlines and give perspectives from, you know, what would this scientist think about this idea? And, you know, it's giving not incredibly deep responses, but kind of on point. You know, certainly better than what I would expect from a lot of undergrad students and maybe even some grad students. So I was impressed.
Now, in Google's presentation last week, their AI chatbot called Bard, at a bad moment for them, made simple mistake about astronomy. What is happening there when these chatbots try to reach into their learning and get it wrong?
Yeah, I think what's happening is, in some ways, similar to what happens with people, we get facts wrong all the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we forget, we confuse one thing for another. And that's what we're seeing here. So you wouldn't expect that from a, you know, you wouldn't expect a calculator to get an arithmetic problem wrong, but people get arithmetic problems wrong all the time. And so do these kinds of models. They approximate. We wouldn't expect them actually to be very factually accurate. And so if the task is real factual accuracy, we should lower our expectations. If the task, though, is, you know, combine some things, organize some knowledge, you know, bounce around some idea, a lot of the kinds of things that we engage with people about, that's where they seem to shine much more than a lot of us had any reason to believe. And so a lot of what we do with search engines, with it's not about looking up facts. It's about trying to. So, for example, when I gave my exams as open book exams and allowed students to use Google, use whatever, their grades didn't go up. They couldn't Google the answers. But plugging in these questions into ChatGPT is giving them sort of often correct answers. So it's able to synthesize knowledge. But if you ask about a specific fact, you should expect that it might not get it right.
Talking to Gary Lupien, cognitive scientist and professor of psychology at UW-Madison, looking at the latest efforts in neural networks, chatbots. And Gary, that doesn't make sense to me. If I can't get the basic facts right, how can I synthesize it? Aren't I building things on a shaky foundation, whether I am, you know, me, Rob Ferret, or a chatbot?
Well, it depends what kind of answer you're looking for. So if what you want is, for example, you're asking about the ways that two short stories are similar and dissimilar. There are some ways to get that totally wrong, but there are many ways of getting it kind of right, because it's not really a fact-based question. It's kind of a opinion. You know, it's much more open-ended. Whereas if you are asking about the features of a vacuum cleaner, which I think was the Bard, the Google, and a factual error, well, you know, that vacuum cleaner has a certain list of features. But those are the things that you can easily look up using traditional search engines. And that's not really where you would need to use these much more powerful tools.
Now, Gary, I want to ask you about potential practical applications and then get into some of what this could tell us about our own ways of thinking. First of all, we're still early days here. What do you see potentially as the most useful application of these kind of chatbots?
I think in the immediate future, the most practical application is going to be in coding and programming. Again, something that most of us really didn't see coming, but part of the training set for these models is computer code. And there are now lots of demonstrations how you can ask it to code, you know, simple programs just using English as a prompt, and it does it. And often it needs to be fixed a little bit, but a lot of what coders have to do is go from, you know, that kind of high-level goal to code. And if you can do those initial steps automatically, that's probably going to shift what a lot of coders are doing day to day. So they'll still have jobs, but those jobs might be changing quite dramatically.
Now, as a cognitive scientist, you don't just wonder about how computers think, but about how people think. Are there lessons you're hoping to bounce back and forth with as we look at these neural networks and then back at our brains and back and forth?
Absolutely, absolutely. So what's amazing about these language models is their input is just language, and yet they learn, for example, a lot about what things look like. And if we look at, for example, people who are born blind, they too know quite a bit about what things look like and how the visual world works. And so this shows us kind of really in very dramatic ways all those things that are embedded in language that we might have thought you actually needed to experience firsthand, but actually it might be possible to learn from language itself, so that it's a much richer repository of knowledge. The flip side of that is all the biases. So, you know, these models, there are sort of guardrails in place to keep them from spouting all sorts of biased things, but they are learning all kinds of biases, stereotypes, and that too is embedded in language. And so it raises this question of to what extent are we also learning a lot of these biases from language itself.
And finally, Gary, people have a lot of concerns about, you know, well, are students going to, in effect, cheat by using these kind of programs to write their essays or college entry exams or essays or what have you? Are we going to have the internet clogged with sort of shaky chatbot-based arguments? Do you have concerns about particular negative consequences of the use of these?
Yeah, I think there is good reason to worry about this, I think assessments are going to have to change in some ways in response. It's not totally clear how. If we're using multiple choice questions and students can just, if they're taking it online and they can just paste in these questions and get the right answer, that's clearly problematic. In many cases, I think we'll learn to use them to allow for better learning. So, for example, in teaching students to code, a lot of the early things that are very frustrating to students are these little syntactic kind of errors that keep their programs from running. And it's just they're spending a lot of time just getting through it, and it's kind of a big barrier to entry. And if they could start by having these kinds of chatbots generate code for them, and then they get to play with them, in some cases ask them, why does this work? The chatbot might not give an answer that's better than the professor's answer, but in the absence of being able, you know, to have a personal conversation for each student with the professor, this could be the next best thing. So to kind of have this conversation and learn from it. The same with language. You know, why is this paragraph a more effective way of conveying this idea than that paragraph? And when you ask it, you often get quite reasonable responses that you as a student can learn from.
Gary, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Gary Lupien, a cognitive scientist, professor of psychology at UW-Madison, with us today to look at the machine learning chatbot programs you may have seen in the news lately that are quickly becoming part of our online experience, including at some big search engines.